Make way for their royal majesties, King and Queen of England!
A few years back, we sent an intern to the Renaissance Festival to meet the king. The year, in Renfest time, was 1549. Princesses in elaborate gowns strolled down dirt paths. Pirates hobbled and scowled while gypsies banged on tambourines. All were subject to one man.
I'm King Edward Jeremiah Plantagenet.
Our intern reported that King Edward, played that year by a local art teacher, was a kind and gentle leader, and that he believed it was better to be loved than feared. But...
perchance from time to time, there are all those who are either commit acts of treason or otherwise, and in order to rule a country, it must be fair and just, and there are times that call for such matters to be ended as such.
The public humiliation of criminals is one of those aspects of the Renaissance Festival that outsiders, like myself, sometimes don't get. It's right up there with turkey legs and hard-to-pinpoint accents from a vague moment in European history. But people love it. They love it. And we are going to find out why from those who know it best. The Renfest performers themselves, they are regular 21st century Midwesterners on weekdays, but they turn into certified knaves and wenches every weekend. Call 816-235-2888 if there's a Renfest tradition that confuses you or just a Renfest story you love and want to tell. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman and Katie Stover. Welcome to KCUR Central Standard.
Pleasure to be here again.
You are a librarian by trade. We usually talk to you on our Bibliophiles show, but you are a tarot card reader at the Renfest, right?
Librarians will read anything.
If you were to explain Renfest and what you like about it to a total outsider, how would you describe the appeal?
I like to think of Renfest as costumed people watching. It's all the history. It's for all members of the family. There really is something for everyone. We were talking about that in the green room earlier. And it's lively, and the energy is crackling and warm and sparkling and just fun. Everyone who comes to the Renaissance Festival comes with one purpose, to have a good time.
Well, I am also here with Kurt Hanover, who plays Bloodbeard the Pirate. Hi, Kurt.
Arr.
Is that like a lot of what you say there?
That and terrible jokes. These are the things that I do in my day. Yes, yes, that's one of the many things that I'll do.
Dress up
like a pirate, make a fool of myself.
You are habitually slipping into an accent that I wonder if you can talk to me about. I've mentioned the accent before.
Yes.
It's a little bit baffling to me.
Well, it's baffling because it's not exactly accurate, is it?
No, it's just kind of, hello, I'm a pirate.
Yeah. It's one of those things that you have to do a fair amount of suspension of disbelief for us out there from time to time.
Okay, well, who is Bloodbeard the Pirate?
Oh, Bloodbeard the Pirate, he's a member of the Jolly Rogers. Yes, the Jolly Rogers. Scandalous people that do a stage show out at the Renaissance Festival. We're not very good pirates, of course. We managed to get ourselves shipwrecked in a landlocked part of the country. I don't know how that happened.
So when you talk about suspension of disbelief, yes. What you are doing right now is also like a lot of having fun with the illogical pieces of
exactly.
The story.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Then that's, and going to what was said earlier about letting people come out and just have fun. It's the suspension of disbelief. Just come out and relax and have a good time, you know, because that's all of our job description, essentially, is to help you have a good time as the patron.
Well, we are going to get back to your story, but we've got, so Katie, the tarot card reader, Bloodbeard the Pirate. I've got one more guest to introduce, Brian Wendling, who plays Bob the Incredible Juggler. And which of those names would you like me to use, Bob or Brian?
I've been married a long time. I'll answer to anything. That's what I always say. Actually, if you call me Bob, I know you know me from a Renaissance environment. It's a name that I had when I worked with a group many years ago. And when the group disbanded, I kept the name. So the longevity of it is kept from that time. So
there are people in real life who will come up to you and call you Bob.
And if they do, I know they know me from a Renaissance fair.
Can you describe what you do as Bob the Incredible Juggler at the Renaissance Festival?
I do a wide range of juggling skills, and I try to be as interactive as I can with the audience. I use a volunteer or two. I use a bullwhip. I walk a tightrope pulled by volunteers in the audience. I'm moving on quickly, as you can tell.
I need you to back up.
I get on a big rolling globe, and I have a wide range of skills.
But the whip.
It's a little personal. I use a volunteer from the audience, and I build up incrementally so that by the end I'm on a very big rolling globe, a big ball, and I crack a stick out of their mouth at the end. And the volunteers don't know it's coming, but they're very kind, and I actually acknowledge this, they're very kind to allow the moment to become the moment. And at the end, I give them a small gift to acknowledge their participation. So it's a little, people come to see what the reaction of the volunteers is if they've seen the show before. And it's something that just happened organically over the years.
So it's, when you talk about something that's evolved organically over the years, over a lot of years, I mean, you've been doing this since 1979?
I have. I missed 2 years. Dr. Dumpe, the fire eater magician I shared the stage with, has been here for 40 years.
Wow.
And in this kind of work, because it is my work, it's very unusual.
That number of years.
Exactly. It's very unusual to work anywhere, like for yourself, for here. To work here for 40 years would be an unusual thing because people tend to move around in their work or in their performing life the same way.
Start by taking me back to that time, 1979 in Kansas City. Renaissance Festival was new here. At this point, it is a huge local tradition, but that was not the case when you started.
No, it was a more fledgling event, and they even brought performers from Minnesota, like myself, down, and I was a fledgling performer.
When you say fledgling performer, can you tell me a little bit more about you at that time?
I'd probably been performing for about 3 years.
Performing in what way?
With a group from Minnesota called Sideshow, and they brought us down to help supplement performers near the end of the run. And I happened to meet my wife then, and a year later I moved here, and when the group disbanded, I continued at the festival. There's a lot of history, and all of us know a lot of history about it. But there used to be incredible performers that were inspirational to all of us in our own ways. And that's maybe for another show. But the life of the festival is really a historical thing for us because we lived through so much, all of us.
I do want you to tell that story. What I want first, you just talked about being part of a group called, was it Sideshow?
Sideshow.
So can you just, and you are a juggler, how would you describe and even classify the style of performance that you specialize in?
Audience interactive, improvisational, but not always improvisational feel to it. Very no fourth wall. So that you're not presentational. Your ability to interact with the audience is very strong. So
you're not standing on a stage with a darkened...
And I'm not playing music and trying to engage people that way, which I think is a very special art as well. But I'm able to force the issue and engage in a way that's more active.
Can you give me an example of an interaction that you've had in your role as Bob the Juggler? The Incredible Juggler, sorry.
Yeah. There's a videotape of a little boy about 4 years old. It's about 30 years ago. And he comes up on stage and he picks up an object I've dropped. And there's a progression that goes for about 5-10 minutes, and he keeps helping me, and then he becomes the star, and then he knows he's the star, and then he...
How do you see that he knows he's the star?
You can see it in his eye, and after a while, he drops a prop, the audience laughs, and he knows that if he drops it again, they're going to laugh, and so he forgets about me, and he doesn't listen to me anymore, and so finally at the end, I go out and grab a machete, which I had in my trunk, and I just hold it in the air, he looks at me, then he walks off the stage. But I mean, those are the moments we all have out there. I mean, if you're doing a reading or if you're doing a stage show, and those are the ones you can't expect, and those are the ones you sort of live for, and I think that's, I don't want to speak for you two, but
no, I would love to hear some of those. Kurt, tell me about one of those moments you've had.
Oh, an interaction that we've had that was, let's see. Well, we've been doing this not as long as Brian has, but we've been doing it since 1991. So there's been a number of different interactions. I think it's not necessarily something that happens on stage, but it has happened to us a number of times where we've had people come up to us after our shows and proceed to tell us about how, you know, oh man, I've been watching your show since I was a kid. this is my kid.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've grown up. You know, they came out here when they were, you know, X years old, who knows, and they've grown up, they've started a family of their own, and now they're bringing their own child out. And so sometimes they'll come up and they'll have a picture with us and this kind of thing. There's one family that comes out that I have, I take a picture, the same picture with this same guy, and we've been doing it since he was this tall.
Wow.
And now, he's three or four years old. And then, you know, now I think he's probably in 20, 21 years old, something like that. And every year he comes out and we do the exact same picture. And they gave me a hardback book that they made of all the pictures we'd done over the years.
So when someone is that into what you do, what do you think it is about the Jolly Rogers? Is that kind of a standard thing for a Renaissance festival to have this group of pirates doing a show, or is that a special Kansas City thing?
Well, I mean, I think that it's, as you were saying with Brian earlier, it is, I think it is a special thing that we've been doing it this long that has enabled us to be able to get, you know, to get people that have noticed that we're out here that keep coming back to see what we're doing and that's meaningful for them. I imagine that kind of thing happens at Renaissance festivals all over the place, that you have those special moments, because we have done some traveling to different Renaissance festivals and we find that there's those people that come back year after year after year. So that kind of inclusion with the audience happens a lot. But yeah, it's a very special thing to come out there and have those people come out and be a part of it like that.
Katie, I'm going to get some of your stories later, but mm-hmm. I want to get back to Brian Wendling, Bob the Incredible Juggler, to talk about you. I mean, you mentioned...
Well, he's the talented one. So.
I'm the oldest one.
Well, we were talking earlier about things that have evolved really organically, specifically as part of the Kansas City scene, and that you've been there since really the beginning, and really, like 1979.
Pretty close.
Talk to me about what it was like then, and you mentioned some of the characters and some of the, just really take me there and help me understand the history of Kansas City's Renaissance Festival.
Wow. There's other people that know better than I, but I think part of it is that it was a rainy weekend this weekend. And so near the end of my day yesterday, we sat down with a couple of women that have come to see me for a long time, and Dr. Jumpe, Rod Sipe, another performer who's been there longer than I. We were talking to them and we were trying to remember all these performers that had been through there. And because it's cyclical, not everybody is there forever, but there are times and people that just you remember. And everybody had a little bit of the history because everybody had a little piece of the picture. So, but there's been, you've heard of Penn and Teller. Penn and Teller started at a Renaissance fair. They started at the Minnesota Renaissance Fair as called the Asparagus Valley Cultural Society. They had a musicologist, and they were there. Then they, after all this, they went out to the Bay Area, worked a club for a year and a half, became big, went away for a while. Then they came back and became big again. And I saw them when they were getting big again at a comedy club in Minnesota, where Penn, the guy that talks, did a fire-eating routine, like you would do at a Renaissance fair, in the dark, just him talking, doing that. So there are exceptional performers that have come in and out all over the place. You have the rat lady that goes through and that grosses out the people. You've got...
Wait, what does she do?
Oh, she had... Did she have real rats? I can't remember.
I think she had a couple real rats.
Yeah, but then fake ones on her costume. Yeah. And, you know, people were both grossed out and intrigued at the same time. And, you have a headless person walking around. And you've got just so many characters over the years. And even now you have them now. You've got... is it Pigpen? I forget. There's a gentleman that walks around dragging like a can. He's all dirty and he's doing words that aren't even words, but he's so funny because he's just, you believe he is who he is when he does. Even I believe he never goes out of character ever. So there's lots of moments and things like
Madame
that.
Madame Red. She's been out there forever with her brothel girls.
That's true.
And they are always spot on. That woman is never out of character. Right. Neither are her girls.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
This seems in some ways like the intention is very sincere, but in the moment there's a lot of theater of the absurd. And there's a lot of tongue-in-cheek humor, I guess.
Of course.
So Okay, I am Gina Kaufman. I'm here with a couple of Renaissance Festival performers here in town. They're helping me understand this Kansas City tradition a little better. Because even though I have been to the Renaissance Festival, but mostly as a kid, and I am going to readily admit that I don't totally get it, and I say that with all the respect in the world, but I don't totally get it. This has been enlightening so far. We've talked about the accents, but can we? Part of staying in the character that goes along with the accents is a certain kind of lingo that I want to know more about. Can you talk to me about the thing I remember is knaves and wenches, but help me put that in context a little bit.
I don't hear very much of that language, only because I'm not traveling around the park as much. I'm usually watching the dramas unfold in the path right outside my window between the Tarot House and Castile Gallery. So I hear a lot of high English language and accents, a lot of Shakespeare. I hear a lot of people just spouting Shakespearean phrases. A lot of people ducking the king and queen too because they don't want to bow or curtsy.
Okay, but this brings me also to this. There's like a social hierarchy in this world that most of us would not be into in real life. I don't think we would. Are there still slaves?
No, I don't see any.
No. There's nothing like that at the Renaissance Festival.
It's not accurate to that degree.
Yeah,
but there's certainly a social class. Right. And even if you look at the costuming, the royalty have ornate. Mm-hmm. Ornate costumes. And the Jolly Rogers have really nice costumes for different weather, right? You've got leather outfits in the rain. I'm a juggler. My costume is really nothing to speak of because I'm very low on the status, the class totem pole. So, yeah
there's peasants, and below that, there's jugglers.
So, okay, but
I'm never talking to you again.
I'm on a level with the juggler as far as costume.
Because you're a seer and you're a. Yeah, sure, yeah.
Great.
I want to just say, though, we're laughing at this, but most of us wouldn't laugh at the thing. You know what I'm saying? Help me get this.
Well, I mean, it's wonderful when you can come at this from, 400 or 500 years after it took place.
Exactly.
You know, so it's just like, you know, with the Jolly Rogers, we do a singing comedy pirate show. We dress up like pirates. If you really take a look at pirates, and it doesn't take you long, if you take a genuine look, well, they're all murderers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is not fun. Yeah. But so we're more in this fantasy version of pirates. And when you see the peasants, the people playing peasants out in the streets, they're all happy. They're thrilled to be peasants.
You know, I do have to tell you, I know someone who as a child played the role of maybe it was called serfs or peasants,
sure.
Not slaves.
Sure.
But he had to push a heavy swing all day long. And he was actually doing this to raise money to go to Boy Scout camp.
Okay, yeah.
He didn't love it. He did not love being a peasant all day.
Well, that's it. He may not have, but the character does. That's what's important. As far as the patrons are concerned...
That's true.
You know, the characters love being out there. The royal court loves, you know, walking around and talking to you. The stage acts, you know, it's again, we're all there to help the patrons have a good day.
And the physical environment is not always an easy one. That's
right.
True for the person that you knew. It's true. I mean, you know, rain
this
or shine.
Weekend is
rain or shine, yeah. And if you find us out there, you might have intimate moments in a day that the weather is bad. And then, you know, 300, 400, 500 people in a show later on. So you don't judge the audience. You just take the moment and you make the moment, no matter how many people, you make that moment the best you can. That's what we all try to do, I think.
So we're okay that I'm still a little uncomfortable about this whole social hierarchy thing.
I can understand why you'd be uncomfortable because when I first started working out there, I was a little uncomfortable. I had a tough time finding the right rig to wear and getting my gear together, and I would run through the park from P-gate to the house and avoid some of the crafters and the characters and the vendors because I wasn't quite certain how to behave. But as the years went by, I realized, okay, the minute I step into the park, it's time to suspend disbelief. It's time to enter this fantasy world. Every once in a while, the real world pops in, and I just remind myself, we're only here till 7 p.m. And my goal is to make sure that anyone who sits at the table has the best
for a tarot card reading.
For a tarot card reading, for a tarot card reading or anything else, has the best Renaissance Festival experience possible.
Okay, Katie, yeah. I am going to ask you about how you got into this quickly. And maybe if you can also, in that telling, help me understand what I'm not privy to as an outsider.
Well, one of the things I've noticed is that I have not been, if you're coming at it from an outsider, you see a lot of the relationships and you feel, oh, I don't really understand that. So that took time for me to understand the relationships between everybody. But once I did, I feel so much more comfortable working in the park. And I came to doing this at the Renaissance Festival because somebody needed a fill-in tarot reader. And they were a volunteer at the library. And they said, well, you do this. I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll fill in. And my very first time filling in, I was scared out of my mind. I had not done this in public. But I had a lot of fun, and I started meeting the other tarot readers and some of the other crafters, and some of the performers come in for readings, and I started to have so much more fun doing it, and that's how I got into it.
So, Katie, you are going to read my cards. I've had a reading before, so I'm vaguely familiar with how this works, but it's been a long time. Refresh my memory.
Well, I've laid the cards out here, and I'm going to have you pull three. Typically, I would have you shuffle the cards and get your essence into them, but I've been warming them up, and they're in good shape. Right now, they're in close proximity
to
you.
And just before we start, what is the purpose of this? It is not quite fortune-telling. It is something else.
No. The way I read cards at the festival is I ask folks, what do you want to know? And most of the time, I get, when am I getting married? when am I going to meet the man? And I have, when am I going to meet the woman? And I have spreads that are just for love, so I'll bust those out. Most of the time, people say, oh, I don't know. So I say, why don't you shuffle the cards and ask them to tell you what you should be paying attention to in your life right now?
Okay, I'll do that.
That's what you should do.
This is what I want to know.
Yep,
what should I be paying attention to?
You should pull three cards, and the tarot cards will tell you what you should be paying attention to now. What should you be focusing on?
Okay.
Let's see. Okay. So what we've got here is, let's see, you pulled this one first. And order does matter. So you pulled this one first, and then you pulled the Devil and the Page of Swords and the Magician.
Ooh, these sound yeah. like intriguing characters.
They do.
So what should I be paying attention to based on these cards?
Right now, you're in a period where you've got some baggage, some emotional stuff, and just general garbage that you need to dump.
All right.
So the Devil is about, you know, breaking the chains of the things that are holding you back. You can't reach this door where the clear light is until you let go of these things you think are valuable and important. They're actually chaining you. They're burdens that you need to unload. Once you do that, you're going to be moving forward with this intellectual pursuit, this idea that you've got, and it is something to do with your work, which will bring you to a level of mastery. But you cannot get there until you dump this junk first.
So the Magician is about mastery and work?
Well, in this reading, yes, the way it's working with these three cards, yes. Otherwise, he can sometimes be a manipulative person. He can be someone who's a bit of a trickster. But in this reading, you dump this garbage here from the Devil. You move forward with this idea because once you go...
Do I get to be a lady in a blue tunic skipping through a meadow with a sword like that lady on this card?
Do you know what else that card means?
No.
Don't run with scissors. So this idea will have you be energized and you're just going to want to move. And you've got a lot of will. The Magician is also about our will and how well we can move forward, what we want to do with our life. So this is going to speak to your skill set and you'll want to move forward. But be careful that you're not running with scissors with this idea, that you're not just jumping into it and acting impulsively.
Okay, that's a lot to process. I mean, I'm going to say that I like that Devil card at first with all the baggage that's holding. Wouldn't that always be true for everyone?
Typically, yes. It depends on when he shows up. And since that card showed up right at the beginning of your reading that would just tell me that right now...
That this is the most pressing thing. Right get rid now, of the baggage. Yeah,
right now, you are... Before you can get to this point, and there's a germ of an idea here, right now you are struggling with some stuff that you need to leave behind.
You must have some very personal experience, because we're doing this on the radio, which I imagine is very different from when you're sitting in a private... little cabin, essentially, with someone and one-on-one having this conversation.
Oh, there have been wonderful moments where I've had couples sit down and they ask about their relationship. And so I do a particular spread on their relationship. And it was really gratifying last year to do a spread for a couple who were on the verge of getting engaged. And after I laid out their cards, they talked about that. They were just so happy and bubbly and warm, and they left all sorts of wonderful energy all over my table. They came back this year to tell me they got married and they wanted another reading, and things were looking really well. One of them asked about a family, and I'm like, well, you're moving towards there, but no baby cards.
Katie, you're going to have to jog out in just a moment, but I do want to know, you know, in the midst of an atmosphere that is so much about theater, this is very not theatrical in a way. I mean, you're talking about the most vulnerable, real, deep things in people's lives.
Oh, yes. I have turned over things that are very serious. And most of the time when people sit down and ask me questions like, should I be in this relationship? And I did have that over 2 weekends ago. It was not sad. It was not a good reading at all. But the woman and I worked through it. People like to use me a little bit for therapy as a dumping ground for their stuff, and that's okay. I also go with that in mind, that it's okay for them to give me things to think about and to talk about.
Katie Stover, thank you for the reading.
You're very welcome.
Katie reads tarot cards at the Renaissance Festival in Bonner Springs. Kurt Hanover and Brian Wendling have joined us as well. They are Bloodbeard the Pirate and Bob the Incredible Juggler, respectively. Thank you both.
Absolutely. Great.
This coming weekend is the final weekend of RenFest. In just a minute, KCUR Central Standard brings you a new episode of My Fellow Kansans, a podcast about Kansas politics leading up to the governor's race. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. Between now and November, leading up to the midterm elections, we are doing a couple of things on this show. One is we're talking to first-time voters. We've heard from people who were formerly incarcerated, immigrants who just became citizens, and we've talked to folks who just didn't feel motivated in the past. Tomorrow, we're talking to young voters who weren't old enough last time around. If that's you or someone you know, share what this moment means to you. Call in during the show or tweet us now. We're at KCURCST. The other thing we're doing is playing a podcast every Tuesday. My Fellow Kansans from the Kansas News Service is putting the governor's race in perspective. Today's episode is all about the legacy of Sam Brownback and his notorious tax experiment.
It's been a great pleasure and honor of mine to serve the people of the state of Kansas in various capacities for over 30 years. I've loved it. I am from this state. I am of this state. And it's just been a hoot.
He had been agriculture secretary, congressman, senator. But when Sam Brownback captured the governor's office in 2010, he had even bigger plans. Plans to transform Kansas into a red state model for the nation. But that's not the way things panned out.
Come listen to my story about a man named Sam Brownback.
The deep income tax cuts Brownback pushed for and got Kansas lawmakers to approve succeeded in making the state a model, but one to avoid, not emulate.
And all because Governor Brownback, like so many Republicans, refuses to give up on the long discredited zombie law. Zombie lie of trickle-down economics. He slashed taxes for the wealthy and eliminated business taxes that were the state's primary source of revenue. And guess what? The state lost all its revenue and crashed. Who could have predicted it besides everyone?
Brownback limped to a re-election victory in 2014. His tax experiment had become the butt of jokes on late-night television across the country. And he spent much of his second term ranked among the least popular governors in the nation. His political career in ruins, Brownback accepted a lifeline from the Trump administration. But even then, Vice President Mike Pence had to cast the tiebreaker to get him confirmed as ambassador for religious freedom.
On this vote, the yeas are 49, the nays are 49. The Senate being equally divided, the vice president votes in the affirmative, and the nomination is confirmed.
I'm Jim McLean, and this is My Fellow Kansans, a podcast from the Kansas News Service. Sam Brownback has left the building, so to speak, but his shadow still hangs over Kansas and its politics, and definitely this year's governor's race.
Governor Brownback once said that Kansas doesn't have mountains or oceans, so we need his tax experiment.
We can either go backward and repeat the last 8 years of the Brownback devastation, or we can elect a governor who will work like the devil to rebuild our state.
If you're going to cut taxes, which I want to do, and that is one of my top priorities, I'm going to cut spending. That is the mistake of the Brownback administration.
On this episode of My Fellow Kansans, we'll continue our examination of the people and events that triggered a turn to the right in Kansas, with a look back at Sam Brownback, one of, if not the key player in that transformation. We'll cover Brownback's ascension to the top of Kansas politics as a figurehead of the Christian right, his campaign to consolidate power with the purge of the legislature in 2012, and the anti-Brownback revolt staged by voters in 2016. From an early age, it was clear that Sam Brownback had ambition, the kind that successful politicians just about have to have. Listen to this ad produced for his 1996 campaign for the U.S. Senate.
He's all Kansas. Raised on a Kansas farm, his folks still operate. State president of the FFA. President K-State student body. President of his KU law class. Kansas Secretary of Agriculture. Chosen as a White House fellow. Congressman.
I agree. This is the member we need, Sam.
Dad. Sam Brownback for the U.S. Senate.
Signs of ambition through and through, right? A steady and purposeful trajectory toward politics. If there had been a future governors of Kansas and maybe president someday club, well, Brownback might well have been president of that, too. By 2006, Brownback was a senator making a presidential bid, and that got him a profile in Rolling Stone magazine. The magazine described Brownback's initial foray into elective politics this way.
He squeaked into Congress running as a moderate. But in Washington, in the midst of the Gingrich Revolution, Brownback didn't just tack right. He unzipped his quiet Kansan costume and stepped out as the leader of the New Federalist, the small but potent faction of freshmen determined to get rid of government almost entirely. When he discovered that the Republican leadership wasn't really interested in derailing its own gravy train, Brownback began spending more time with his Bible. He began to suspect that the problem with government wasn't just too many taxes, it was not enough God.
Brownback's election to Congress coincided with another big event in his life, one that, according to those close to him, fundamentally changed his outlook and purpose.
It started, he says, with a strange bump on his right side, a melanoma diagnosed in 1995.
Brownback talked about his purification through cancer in the Rolling Stone article.
The doctors scooped out a piece of his flesh, Brownback says, as if murmuring to himself. A minor procedure, but it scared him. In his mind, he lost hold of everything. He asked himself, what have I done with my life? The answer seemed to be nothing. One night while his family was sleeping, Brownback got up and pulled out a copy of his resume. Sitting in his silent house in the middle of the night, a scar over his ribs where cancer had been carved out of his body, he looked down at the piece of paper. His work, the laws he had passed. This must be who I am, he thought. Then he realized nothing he had done would last. All his accomplishments were humdrum conservative measures, bureaucratic wrangling, legislation that had nothing to do with God. They were worth nothing. Brownback turns, holds my gaze. So, he says, I burned it. He smiles. He pauses. He's waiting to see if I understand. He had cleansed himself with fire. He had made himself pure. I'm a child of the living God, he explains. I nod. You are too, he says.
That spiritual awakening seemed to drive Brownback's politics. During his 14 years in the U.S. Senate, he earned a reputation as one of the nation's preeminent social conservatives.
And I'm introducing today, along with 30 co-sponsors, a bill called the Unborn Child Pain Awareness Act.
Led fights on culture war issues like abortion and same-sex marriage.
But the best, the optimal setting is in the union between a man and a woman, bonded together for life, and a child, children raised in that setting. And that's something we've got social data on, but we know that in our hearts.
But he also took on other less partisan causes, human trafficking, and the genocide in Darfur.
When I talk about being pro-life and whole life, the child in the womb is sacred, child in Darfur is too.
It was that reputation that Brownback hoped would help him stand out in the crowded race for the 2008 Republican presidential nomination.
Hi, I'm Sam Brownback, and we need your help. We're moving forward in Iowa. We did very well in Ames, Iowa at the straw poll, finishing third there. And we want to move that on forward into the caucuses. Been pushing a strong set of values as the...
Brownback had high hopes in Iowa, running against Mike Huckabee, Mitt Romney, and John McCain, and others. He thought the time was right for his brand of conservatism.
If these ideas are your ideas, help me out. We need you.
Not enough did. Unable to raise enough money to be competitive, Brownback dropped out of the race 3 months before the caucuses and set his sights instead on winning the Kansas governor's office in 2010. He won that race easily over Tom Holland, a little-known Democratic state senator from Baldwin City.
Thank you. Wow, what a wave. This has really been a night, a clean sweep for a new beginning. No more Obama way, now to the Kansas way. Way is holding down taxes, holding down regulations, controlling spending. That's our route.
Inaugurated in January of 2011, Brownback got right to work on his red state model. He privatized Medicaid, made welfare and food stamps harder to get, he said, to break people's dependence on government. And in 2012, he pushed lawmakers to approve deep cuts in individual and business income taxes, saying it would jumpstart the Kansas economy like a shot of adrenaline.
We've cut taxes. We went to zero on LLC and sub-S pass-through income. So anybody interested in moving to Kansas, come to Kansas. Better than Texas on small business.
Early in his term, Brownback traveled the country, touting his red state vision. Here he is describing it to a conservative group in New York.
This is a red state model. We've got strong family issues. I've signed 6 pro-life bills that have come forward. We want to be the best state in America. Pretty simple. We want to be the best state in America to raise a family and grow a small business. And we're moving fast that way. And then you got blue state models out here saying, okay, we need to raise taxes to pay more for public sector things. We need to have a bigger government to take care of more of the problems. To me, it's a fascinating time in U.S. history because normally the country kind of tracks one way or tracks another, and now you've got it going two ways fast. I think you change America by changing states and by proving that your model works, and your model for growth, and your model for opportunity, and your model for helping people.
The nation was watching to see whether his supply-side experiment would succeed where others had failed, and Brownback was riding high. He had gotten his tax cuts, but it wasn't easy. He had to maneuver around a knot of moderate Republicans in the Kansas Senate.
You're probably aware of what Brownback did. I don't know whether you want me to go into details on how that happened or not, but...
The moderates, led by Senate President Steve Morris, warned that cutting taxes would wreck the state budget.
He outlined what he wanted to do, and he wanted to basically do away with income tax. And we were still just coming out of the recession of 2008. And we thought, well, we can't do that. We're still trying to get our heads above water. In fact,
conservatives managed to get the legislation Brownback wanted to the floor, a bill starting the march to zero income taxes. But the Senate voted it down.
And ultimately, we killed the bill. I was presiding, and my assistant came and got me and said, the governor's on the phone. He has to talk to you. So I go to my office. He starts in pleading with me. Under our rules, we could reconsider anything that was passed or killed within 24 hours.
Brownback said he wanted a chance for a compromise on the tax cuts. But for that to even be possible, the Senate had to pass the bill and send it back to the House so there would be something to negotiate. After more pleading from the governor, Morris agreed to bring the legislation back to the floor.
So we ended up passing it with the understanding that it would never become law. Well, we went to conference, and we actually made some suggestions to the conferees about a much more modest tax reduction. They wouldn't even look at it.
Brownback and his allies in the House refused to negotiate a compromise. Instead, they rushed the version of the bill that Brownback had assured Morris would never become law through the House.
Passed to concur while we were still debating this other conference committee report. Anyway, he lied to us, he stabbed us in the back, and that's how that became law, and of course he signed it. The next year, they came back and made it even worse.
Brownback, the Kansas Chamber, and other groups tied to Wichita's powerful Koch brothers didn't want a faction of moderate Republican senators blocking their agenda, so they went after them in what came to be known as the 2012 Purge.
We considered ourselves moderates, and we had 21 races, and we lost 16 of those races.
Morris was among the casualties.
And we were sort of steamrolled by the governor and the Kansas Chamber and Koch-related entities such as Americans for Prosperity and Club for Growth. And they sent out a huge number of mailings the last 3 weeks of the campaign, usually a couple a day. And very negative, very not truthful.
Welcome to another episode of Where in the World is Steve Morris? I'm your host, Johnny Q. Tex.
They didn't do TV, but they did radio. 24/7, every 5 minutes, they had the same kind of dialogue on that came out in the mailings.
Beijing?
That's right. In 2005, Steve Morris used his position to get a free trip to China. Jennifer, you're our big winner.
What do I get?
Thanks to Steve Morris, you get higher taxes and fewer jobs. Paid for by the Kansas Chamber PAC, Jeff Glendenning, Treasurer.
As I said, we got steamrolled and lost the primary.
The purge coincided with KU political scientist Patrick Miller's arrival in the state.
You have a state legislature that had been under Republican control, but when you slice and dice the politics of it, Democrats and your moderate Republicans were often typically the majority and could pass legislation that they wanted if they came together on a particular issue, or could stop legislation. So you really have this period of the Senate, the House, the governorship being under clear conservative control, and them really being able to advance their agenda for the first time in a very long time, maybe if not ever. If we go back and think of Brownback historically, when you thought of Sam Brownback, you thought of socially conservative politics. You thought of abortion, gay rights, religious issues, human rights to an extent. He'd worked on that a little bit in the Senate. You didn't think of someone who was a diehard on economic issues, though certainly he was economically conservative. And then when he becomes governor, the economic issues come a lot more to the forefront. Mm-hmm. I think part of that just comes with the office. A governor has a lot of power over fiscal, economic, and spending issues that a senator who is just one of 100 people does not have. I mean, if Sam Brownback had been president, we might have seen more of this come out.
He still perceived himself, still thought himself as a potential presidential contender at that time.
Maybe he did, maybe he didn't, but people thought of him as one. He had run for president in 2008, not done very well. And there was talk, again, how true, who knows, that if he came back to Kansas and this red state model was effective, that he could be someone who we could look at as a possible presidential contender.
Well, you think that was the architecture he was envisioning, that he would come back to Kansas, which is fairly, relatively speaking, a pretty small political playground, and a place with which he was familiar, and a place that the economy wasn't doing that well, the state wasn't growing, and so he was going to remake it in this Republican red state image, and that was going to be a shining example of the effectiveness of these policies, and that would then propel him back to national prominence. Was that the thought process, do you think?
I think that's the thought process that a lot of people projected onto it, and that may or may not have been his own thought process. I mean, he never came out and said, this will be successful, and then I can run for president again. Mm-hmm. But that narrative was out there. But also after 2010, Republicans really come into an unprecedented level of control of states that they hadn't seen in a very long time.
Not just Kansas, across the
board. Not just Kansas, but across the country. And the Koch brothers and other Republican super rich donors have played a huge role in that. We started to see super PACs come out, and we started to see these billionaire donors really invest a lot in state politics. So there were a lot of Republican governors who were experimenting with policy in their own ways. Brownback probably stands out the most on taxes, but Brownback was not alone in that.
So, but shortly after you got here, we had the 2014 election. Paul Davis, the legislator from Lawrence, the Democratic leader in the Kansas House, challenged the sitting Republican governor and came pretty close to beating him. Why was Brownback all of a sudden politically vulnerable?
You know, there were a few Republican governors that year, Mary Fallon in Oklahoma, right next door, for example, who had implemented some of these major policy changes, and they didn't go the way that they were supposed to go. So even in a good Republican year, there were a few of these Republican governors who had experienced blowback or negative policy consequences to the changes they implemented and found themselves in unusually competitive races.
And Brownback was among those.
Brownback was definitely among those. So by 2014, we had, you know, the tax cuts had been implemented and revenue had fallen quite dramatically. And it seemed like we were in just a constant budget crisis.
And by 2016, Kansans were really feeling it and letting their lawmakers know it. That caught conservative State Senator Forrest Knox off guard during an early campaign swing in southeast Kansas that year.
Let me tell you about my listening to the people in Kansas are dissatisfied with our government. And I don't know how long it's going to take you people to realize that we're not happy with him and we're not happy with what's going on.
Okay.
Well,
I read that in the papers regularly.
But you don't do anything about it.
let me give me a few minutes to tell you about what I've heard for the last 4 days.
Out in western Kansas, people were souring on the governor and his allies in the legislature, too. People like Robin Nordyke, who after 45 years was just retiring from her job as a public school teacher in Ulysses. She was a registered Republican and had once voted for Brownback, but she was regretting it.
Well, I think people are starting to realize that education isn't being funded like it should be. And I think with the threat that schools might close, that's wakened a few people up. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if schools don't open, then parents have no place for their children to go while they're working.
If this was D.C. and we could just run a deficit, then
again, Patrick Miller.
You know, Brownback wouldn't have had all the negative headlines and the various cuts to education or transportation or other programs that I think a lot of people felt very hard in different communities.
Senate District 21, Dinah Sykes.
Thank you. Thank you all, to all the people in Lenexa and Overland Park for choosing me as a Republican nominee.
A few months later, Democrats and moderate Republicans were celebrating legislative victories. They had harnessed that angst over what Brownback's tenure had wrought, shrinking school budgets, canceled road projects, and limits on health care. And they toppled a third of the conservatives in the legislature. Kansas, it appeared, was swinging back to the center. Having unseated an incumbent member of the House in the GOP primary, Joy Kostin described for the Kansas City Star the centrist coalition that would form in the state house.
I'm hoping that many of us can join the other moderates that serve in the legislature now, both Democrats and Republicans, who can maybe think about what's really needed here in Kansas and really work together to find the solutions that are best for our state.
In June of 2017, with the session in overtime and lawmakers wrangling with how to solve a billion-dollar budget crisis, that newly bolstered coalition of moderate Republicans and Democrats, well, they repealed Sam Brownback's signature tax cuts.
Breaking tonight at 10, within the past few minutes, Kansas lawmakers approved a massive tax increase in Kansas.
The governor's veto, approving a major tax increase in
the state. Live at the State House now, James.
And it's been an emotional night here at the State House.
I look at this as bittersweet. I don't like the bill. Hate the bill.
But we have to move forward as a state.
Statements made tonight about us taking money from Kansans, that is absolutely untrue.
I think it's very exciting that Kansas is turning the page on the tax experiment. That's over. And we're back on the...
But has Kansas really turned that page? Is it trending back to its centrist roots? That's next time on My Fellow Kansans.
That was Jim McLean of the Kansas News Service based here at KCUR. They're digging into the stories behind some of the distinctive features of Kansas politics, things we might just take as a given without really remembering how we got here. It's how we're making sense of everything going on with the 2018 governor's race. My Fellow Kansans is edited by Amy Jeffries and mixed by Matthew Long Middleton, and we're playing it every Tuesday till the election on Central Standard. That's a wrap for today's show. You can grab anything you may have missed at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Earlier in the show, we talked about the Renaissance Festival and the lifestyle that goes along with it for the people who are a part of it. Tomorrow, we are talking to first-time voters. Young voters who were not old enough to cast a ballot in past elections. Will they turn out and change things up for a midterm? And what do they care about? Tweet us with your story if this is you. We are at KCURCST, and we really want the young voters out there to tell us what's up. At KCURCST, or tune in tomorrow at 10 and give us a call. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Kathleen Pointer, and Suzanne Hogan. Sophia Gillespie is our intern, Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer, and I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.